What was behind the biggest art heist in history?
And I learned about a motive that Boston, maybe uniquely, the underworld in Boston believes. And that is that if you can get something dear enough, like a painting, like a exquisite piece of art, that you can deal with the authorities to try to get a deal done for someone who's close to you in your ring.
That's Stephen Kirkchin. We talk with him about his new book, Master Thieves. It's about the 1990 theft at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, and who might have done it. Then, 40 years after the end of the Vietnam War, its lethal legacy continues.
10% of all the bombs that were dropped on Vietnam never exploded, and people were walking on them in the fields the whole time, getting blown up, killed, maimed, blinded. The most heavily bombed place in the country, and in fact the most heavily bombed place in the history of the world, was Quang Tri province, which is...
That's George Black. We talk with him about his terrific story in the March 16th issue of The Nation magazine, The Lethal Legacy of the Vietnam War. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. On March 18, 1990, two men disguised as Boston police officers snuck into the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston and walked off with the most valuable single haul of artwork in history. Estimated worth $500 million, including works by Rembrandt, Vermeer, and Manet. 25 years later, the spaces where the paintings hung are still empty, and the thieves have never been caught. The loss to the public is incalculable. The exquisite Vermeer painting, The Concert, lost to all except in reproductions. The only major seascape by Rembrandt, Christ in a Storm on the Sea of Galilee, gone. Are the paintings even intact? Why has the FBI, which has poured a boatload of resources into solving the crime, failed utterly at its mission? Why has the $5 million reward and amnesty for the criminals gone unclaimed? These questions are explored in my guest Stephen Kirkchin's new book, Master Thieves, The Boston Gangsters Who Pulled Off the World's Greatest Art Heist. In the book, he develops a theory about why the theft was committed, who did it, and even why it remains unsolved. A Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who retired from the Boston Globe after four decades of reporting, Kirkchin has been following the case since 1997. He went deep into Boston's underworld to get the story and ended up questioning the FBI's conduct of the case. The book is a page-turner, a true crime story that will have you on the edge of your seat. But Steve Kirkchin's purpose goes beyond selling books. He wants to engage the public in the hope that the crime will finally be solved, and his beloved Boston will once again host some of the greatest masterpieces ever painted. Well, Steve Kirkchin, welcome to Writer's Voice. So this book, Master Thieves, The Boston Gangsters Who Pulled Off the World's Greatest Art Heist, it was a terrific read, really thrilling. But first I want to ask you, this is the world's greatest art heist that ever happened?
Yes, I've had a discussion with my brother-in-law about this the other day, in which he reminded me that during World War II, the Nazis made off with billions of dollars worth of Western, French and Western paintings. But that was over a longer period of time, and thankfully unsuccessful, at least the blatant attempt to rid the French museums was unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. But this is a single episode as far as a theft of artwork taken from a single place at a single time. Yes, this is the largest art theft. You know, it's very difficult to put a price on a Vermeer or a Rembrandt. And there were three Rembrandts, two bigger paintings by Rembrandt, and a Vermeer, one of 34, 36 Vermeers, the only Vermeer left in New England. And it's said by the FBI to be upwards of $500 million or $500 million, and that's, I'm reluctant to tell you, I don't know what the second largest one is, but this is referenced as the largest art theft in world history.
This happened on March 18th of 1990. Give us a sense of what works were stolen. You've already mentioned Rembrandts and Vermeers. Tell us what works were stolen. I mean, not all of them, but some of the big ones.
There were really, really two groups of work. Some were, I hesitate to say throwaway, Degas prints, Degas sketches are not throwaways by any means, but they were minimal in value and in historic value to the what I consider the two greatest, which is the Vermeer, the concert by Vermeer, and Rembrandt's Seascape, the only seascape he ever painted. One of the best works, I'm told, from his early stages, Christ on the Sea of Galilee, Christ in a Storm on the Sea of Galilee. And it shows Christ calming his disciples in a ark, in a boat, which is storm-tossed. And it's the only time that Rembrandt painted the sea, and it's exquisite. It takes your breath away to see how beautiful it is. And so those were the two greatest. There is another Rembrandt, a lady and gentleman in black. The gentleman is standing, the woman is sitting in a posed position, and a very large painting, itself exquisite, but not as vivid as the seascape. And then there was one small little sketch by Rembrandt, a self-portrait, that was almost like a slide, the size of a slide, that was laying on the one of the tables, and that too was snatched. Most of the works were taken from the Dutch room, which is the first room the two men went into. They went into only two rooms on the second floor, even though from their footprints, and there was a machine, there was a piece of equipment that tracked which rooms they were in. But there was one other portrait by Manet, Edouard Manet, taken from the first floor blue room, taken out of its frame. The frame was left on the security director's chair, and that too was stolen. But mysteriously enough, the equipment did not capture the footprints of the thieves in that room. So it's just another baffling part of the mystery as to why wasn't those footprints captured in that room. When the piece of equipment was later tested, it was said to be working fine. Anthony Amori, who is the security director of the museum and has worked for 10 years diligently, probably more diligently than anybody else, he says that if he had the chance, the one question he would want answered is why they stole what they stole. Because it's just so baffling that some of the pieces that they stole were such of a little historical value. One more anecdote. They went into the gallery where they stole the Degas sketches, and they didn't seem to go in there for those sketches. And they went into the short gallery, and they went in there to apparently steal the Napoleonic banner, which was encased in a wood and glass frame, up off the ground about 5 or 6 feet. They had to jump up on a ledge to get to it. They worked 10 minutes on these small little screws that had encased the frame, and they were not able to open the frame to get at the banner. Yet, they didn't break the glass. In the Dutch gallery, where they stole the Vermeer and the two Rembrandts, they broke the glass frames and they cut them out of their backings and out of their frames. So they were capable of brutality in carrying out this theft, but they didn't show that brutality to the Napoleonic banner. Why? If they were in there at the orchestration of someone, a person who put these thieves to work to steal priceless artwork, he wanted that banner, but they didn't want to ruin it, so they didn't break the frame.
Now, when you're talking about cutting Rembrandts and Vermeers from their frames, one of those Vermeers happens to be one of my favorite paintings. You're from Boston. Had you seen those paintings when they were there in the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum before they were taken?
I remember seeing the Storm of the Sea of Galilee. I don't remember seeing the Vermeer. The Storm was just so vivid and had such a major place. It's a bigger painting.
And what was your reaction when you found out about the heist?
Well, I was in Washington, and I found out about it by reading the paper like everyone else, getting the papers or hearing about it on the news. And I was in Washington as the Globe's bureau chief in Washington. When I came back to Boston the next year in 91, I came back with a bunch of story ideas, and one of the story ideas I had is, why is this mystery still unsolved? Why haven't the bad guys been arrested, the paintings recovered, or some deal exchanged to get these paintings back? So I started to, I was doing some investigative editing, investigative reporting, and overseeing of some investigative reporters, and we did a couple of stories and just could not pierce the veil. FBI is very, very confidential in giving up information, and they weren't helping, and the museum was saying very little about it. So we could do the best we could, which is talk to lawyers and a few criminals who had known in the past to be involved in art theft. And for the ones we looked at, they all were in jail at the time it happened, and they didn't seem to know much about it. And so later on, I started to really pay attention to this after the 10th anniversary in 2000. I said, this is too good a story. I got on another art theft that turned out well and got to understand how the art world and the netherworld in dealing with art worked. And I learned also about a motive that Boston, maybe uniquely, the underworld in Boston believes. And that is that if you can get something dear enough, like a painting, like a exquisite piece of art, that you can deal with the authorities to try to get a deal done for someone who's close to you in your ring. And a deal could be transfer to an easier prison. Deal could be some understanding that to be made with the prosecutors in which charges are dropped or heavy charges are lessened. And if that happens, then the artwork comes back. This all dates back to a case back in the mid-1970s, in which a gentleman named Miles Connor, who is, pretty renowned and, I don't want to say successful, but a known art thief here in the Boston area, Massachusetts area. He had been arrested for stealing some valuable paintings from an estate up in Maine. And he had been charged in that federally. He had tried to fence them to a person he thought was a legitimate buyer, and turned out to be an FBI undercover agent, and he was arrested. So he was locked up, and he was facing trial. And somehow or another, another group of individuals were involved in an art theft with, guns, crazy daytime robbery from the MFA, which they stole a Rembrandt. Mid-70s, 75.
That's the Massachusetts Museum of Fine Arts.
Yeah, right. The Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. A stone's throw from the Gardner. And Miles Connor's lawyer was able to work out a deal with the feds and the state authorities, because the second case was prosecuted by the state, but in which the state case, the case in which the robbery from the MFA was carried out with guns, that those sentences would be served concurrently, which means whatever sentence, and it was probably a 5 or 7 year sentence that was placed on him for the MFA robbery, he served concurrently with the sentence that was imposed on him by a federal judge in the robbery of the Wyeths. There were 5 Wyeth family paintings stolen from the state up in Maine. But out of that negotiation, deal-making, plea bargaining, came sort of a belief, and it's really an illusion, to tell you the truth, that if you can get something so dear that the authorities were willing to negotiate with you, you might be able to get a member of your gang or your criminal associates or a member of your family who's being sentenced or in prison already or facing charges, you can get some negotiation going. I've never seen it happen except for this one time involving Miles Connor, in which the deal was consummated with a concurrent sentence. But the bad guys whom I spoke with for this book absolutely believe to the core that you can get a deal.
Especially if the paintings are by Rembrandt and Vermeer.
Rembrandt and Vermeer. So That's what I found was in my reporting on the case. I sort of led with the principal, and now we'll come up with the anecdotal information, which is an individual whom I spoke with said to me in a very convincing way that that's why this robbery was consummated, in order to get a criminal associate out of jail.
And we'll come back to that point, because I think it's an important, really key. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Stephen Kirchin about his book, Master Thieves, The Boston Gangsters Who Pulled Off the World's Greatest Art Heist. It's about the theft from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston in 1990 of some of the greatest paintings in Western tradition, paintings by Rembrandt, Vermeer, and others. I want to ask you a little bit about some of the theories that were out there before. I mean, it has been 25 years since the heist. The FBI has been pretty much the guys in charge of this investigation. You know, you reported as an investigative journalist for the Boston Globe, you reported on the story of the collusion between Whitey Bulger and the FBI. Talk about the thought that the FBI had that Whitey Bulger was involved in this.
Right.
And also, you know, just a question I had, do you suspect anything here in terms of why has the FBI been unable to solve this crime over 25 years?
Yeah, the Whitey Bulger, I did not report on it. Like the rest of Boston, I read about the Whitey Bulger alliance with the FBI from a Boston Globe spotlight team, which is I was a member of the team, but that was broken in 1988 by the team, and at a period of time I was not a member of the team. That was a remarkable story. And it all turned out to be true, even though Globe editors were told by FBI supervisors that if you print that story, you'll be printing a lie. In fact, the Boston Globe editors were being lied to by the FBI. That's to the extent that they were willing to protect this alliance. To me, it's, there are two great secrets in Boston's history to me in my generation, and one is that Whitey had an alliance with the FBI because he was such a notorious and brutal gang boss. And the second was that the Boston Archdiocese was protecting a condoning priest who had abused children. Or they were taking them out of harm's way, but they were not reporting them to the police, which allowed that scandal to continue. But to go back to Whitey, my sense is that kind of collusion, that kind of forsaking of sins, of crimes that went on with Whitey, that's not part of the answer to why this case has not been solved. My sense is that the FBI wants desperately and will go to any extent to get this case solved. And they have tried every door. They've run down every lead. They have done all sorts of attempts to reach out both to the public and to individuals. And they've pressed people whom they had every sense that this individual may know something. And they've done everything both with insistence and with, offers of no prosecution to come to get to the bottom of the thing. Yet there's been no, what they call a concrete sighting, proof of life sighting of any of the pieces of art.
And we're talking with investigative journalist Stephen Kirchin. He's the author of Master Thieves, The Boston Gangsters Who Pulled Off the World's Greatest Art Heist. You said that they didn't go after the guy that you think had something to do with it.
Well, they may have some information about the guy whose name I put in the book. They may have some information that tells them that he's not, that his version of events is not what they consider a valid story.
Well,
I don't know why they haven't. To me, it offers all sorts of leads for them, yet from my information, at least from the information I get from the individual whose account I got, they have not followed up on it. They may have other information that tells them that it's not worthy of pursuit. I don't know. I did not get a summary or an end-of-book sit-down with them.
So why do you think Robert Donati had something to do with it? Tell us who he is, first of all.
Yeah, Robert Donati, D-O-N-A-T-I, was a local crime associate. He was a member of the gang of Vincent Ferrara and J.R. Russo. They were a more upstart gang of criminals in Boston in the early and mid-'80s and into the 90s. And Donati was almost a sort of an inside source for Vincent Ferrara, who was the head of the crime gang. And in November of 89, Vincent Ferrara got locked up. He was arrested for racketeering. What had happened over the previous 4 or 5 years was that his gang, the Ferrara gang, was trying to take over the Boston underworld. The control of the Boston underworld was up for grabs. The previous family that controlled the Boston underworld, the Angiulo family, had been broken up by indictment by the federal government, and they were all in jail. So the control of the Boston underworld was up for grabs. The person who should have been decided on who would get the control was Raymond Patriarca, but he had died of old age in 84. His son was not strong enough, tough enough, to decide to give it to either the Ferrara gang or the rival gang, which was controlled by Frank Salemi. And so the two sides, the Salemi gang and the Ferrara gang, settled things as it comes down to when no compromise can be fine. That's gunfire. And over 4, 5, 6, 7 years, there was lots of shootings back and forth here in Boston. And in 89, November of 89, Ferrara was arrested by the federal government and put in jail and soon to be indicted on many counts of racketeering and a murder charge. Very soon after he was arrested, I am told on a very good authority that he was visited by Robert Donati. And they knew each other over the years. Donati had been, in fact, Ferrara's driver. They knew each other's family. They were very close personally. And Donati said to him, "I'm going to get you out of jail." And he said, "Don't do anything stupid, Bobby, because no one's going to let me out of jail here." He says, "We're going to do something that's going to make them want to do it, that let you out of jail." Right after the Gardner theft, Ferrara was still in jail. Donati came back and visited him and said, "That's what we did. We got the paintings, and we're going to start the negotiations with the authorities." Came back soon after the third visit to Donati, to Ferrara, and said to him, "We've buried it. Things are too hot right now. The FBI had 45, 50 police officers, 50 agents on the streets of Boston trying to run down who had done this." So Donati did not want to expose himself as being involved because he thought he'd be arrested. But he, too, believed that this bartering process could take effect and he could get the leader of his gang out of jail, which would protect his criminal associates and protect himself personally. Why did Bobby Donati believe this? Because Bobby Donati was involved in the theft 2 decades before, in 1975, up in Maine with Miles Connor, in which the Wyeth paintings were stolen. Interestingly enough, he was never caught for that. His involvement in that was later told by Miles Connor in a book that Miles wrote, and said, "My associate in that one was the late Bobby Donati. Why the late? Bobby Donati, about 6-8 months after the theft from the Gardner Museum, suffered a brutal death. Very, very awful, just a brutal death in Boston. And why was he killed? Some said he was killed because he was an informant against the Ferrara crime ring, an informant against the Salemi crime ring, an informant against some other crime ring. Who was it? Because he knew something about the Gardner? It's not known. But what he is alleged to have, is reported to have told the head of his gang, Vinnie Ferrara, it was that we stole it and we buried it, and we're going to let it stay for a while until things calm down, and then we can begin negotiations. So that's where it stood. And when I learned that back in May of last year, May of 2014, about a month later, I did some confirmation. I did some reporting around Donati from this and learned about an incident in right around the time of the Gardner theft, that Bobby Donati had gone into a little bit of a hole in the wall that in the town of Revere, which is the city of Revere, which is close to where he hung out, and had a bag with two police uniforms in it. And the information I got on that was from a person who saw Donati in this little hangout called the Shack and was showing around the police uniforms. It suggests more than actually is proof positive, but I brought it to the FBI and told them what I knew. And said, you know, this is for you people to determine if true and if there are leads here to follow up. And that's the best I could do.
And there was another man. I mean, these were two guys who dressed up in police uniforms or maybe in security guard uniforms. That's not left completely clear. But there is another guy. Do you have any idea who that might be?
I do not. The Miles Connor in interviews and in the book says that he was visited by a gentleman who he knew from his entourage that hung out with Miles. Is really interesting. He also played in a rock and roll band, and this other fellow hung out with his rock and roll band. And when Miles was in jail in 1990, when the theft came down a few months later, he was visited by this fellow who hung out with his rock and roll band, and he said that he had been with Bobby Donati and they had robbed the Gardner Museum. Unfortunately, the friend is a gentleman named David Houghton, also now died. He died of natural causes. But Houghton was 300 pounds. And I doubt very much that Houghton, that girth, would not have been mentioned or shown in the sketches of the two robbers who were shown in the, that were produced by the two night watchmen who were on that night.
So do you think we're any closer now, after your book, to knowing what happened and to recovery? Because as you point out in the book, you know, the thieves have had, you know, the perfect deal, basically. Not only do they not get prosecuted if they bring back the paintings, but they actually get $5 million.
Right, and that offer has been on the table, I'll say for 10 years, maybe for 7 or 8. Through three U.S. attorneys, it has been stated and restated. The FBI has said that, and has reminded everyone, that the robbers themselves, the prosecution against them for the robbery, was over and done with in 1995. There's a 5-year statute of limitations at the time. Now it's a 20-year statute of limitations for theft from a museum of antiquities. So if someone was to be prosecuted, it would be prosecuted for possession of stolen property or related crimes to possessing stolen property. And the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office has said, you will not be prosecuted if you bring them in. In fact, you know, you will be brought over, invited over to the Gardner Museum with the reward offer of $5 million, which itself is the largest reward offer out there for any valuables that are missing. Will be given to you as long as the material is in good shape.
So what's your conclusion? I mean, if nobody has come forward...
My conclusion is if it wasn't Donati or someone like Donati and they're in a crime business, they're in a dangerous business, and they were killed. If they weren't killed for this, they were killed for some other dangerous score that they were involved in. They rob drug dealers, they rob banks, they rob armored cars, they rob jewelry stores. And they're very aggressive, and they don't compromise. They settle things with the barrel of a gun. So that's one thing. My sense is that the people who knew exactly what happened that night were killed or died of natural circumstances. One thing also I learned in criminal gangs, if there are 10, 15, 20 people who are associated in the gangs, and let's say in Ferrara's gang, there probably was 9 to 20. And Salemi's gang was a little bit looser, but he could call on at least, you know, a dozen people as well. Each of those individuals in the gangs are involved in criminal enterprise, whether racketeering, the loan sharking, drug dealing, robbing, whatever. If two members of that gang, or a gang member himself, pulls off a score, that is not known to the other members of the gang. If two or more people are involved in an enterprise, only they know about it and the crime boss knows about it. The other members of the gang don't know about it. You don't ask another member of the gang, hey, was that you? because you don't want other members of the gang being able, in the parlance of this business, to drop a dime to the feds, to tell the feds something about even one of your trusted members of your gang. There is no honor among these people, and they will drop a dime on each other if they can get something for themselves or members of their family or members of their even closer than a member of their gang. They band together for, it's a loose affiliation. They'll provide money to the person who gave them the tip. They'll provide money or share of the money to the person, to the head of the gang. But after that, there's no commonwealth within. It's only those people who are involved in the heist who get to share in the booty. I don't think it was commonly known inside the gangs as to where this, who had done this, or where the stuff had been stolen.
So, if the principals are dead, do you have any idea as to whether these priceless works of art, in fact, can be recovered?
Yes, I think they can be.
Why?
And that's, I've thought about this, and I come at it from a different direction. And I come at it somewhat from the experience of the Whitey Bulger capture. And I also come at it from the experience of the capture of the younger Sarnaev brother here in Boston. And that is getting the public more involved in the search. And I don't mean just going up to your attic or because your third cousin had a history of, you know, doing robberies to go into, but he's long passed away, to go into his attic or his basement. What I mean is getting the public involved in the talk of what this loss means to Boston. And the way I would do it is to get the leaders of our community, whether they be academic, government, particularly sports, and particularly religious, to get those individuals in front of those empty frames at the Gardner Museum, second floor of the Dutch Gallery, Dutch Room, and see the sadness of those empty frames, the sadness that they represent. This is a collective loss to the city of Boston. This is our loss. Yes, they were owned by the Gardner Museum, the Board of Trustees that oversees and supervises the Gardner Museum, but Mrs. Gardner, the woman who had the vision and the commitment to build this museum, she wanted Boston, she was a certain Boston figure. She wanted Boston to appreciate this art because she felt maybe we could get a new American art genre to develop from this art. And she charged no ticket price to get into the museum. Yes, she had gala events for the upper crusts of Boston at the museum at night. But anybody who wanted to go in during the day just walked in. If you had a few cents and you wanted to put that in as a donation, you could. But you were not charged for years. And she died in 1926, and they still were not charging. She wanted Boston to appreciate the love this art that she had chosen for Boston to love, that she had spent her husband's and her own family's millions to gather and to display for Boston. And that loss is being lessened over the years. We've thought of this as a crime story. I don't think in a crime story that needs to be solved by arresting someone. I don't think that's going to get it. 25 years we've tried. I don't think that gets it. The way of getting this is appealing to those people who may know something secondhand or thirdhand, who were members or family members of those members who were members of either of these two gangs, to say, you know, it's enough. These pieces belong back to the museum. Boston needs to appreciate this artwork. This is more than a cold case. This is sort of like a piece of our treasure, piece of our history, our Boston's history, is missing. And I think if that clarion call can be made, and that sense of loss can be captured and conveyed by our Boston leaders, I think we might be able to start a buzz and get the right people saying, who might know something secondhand or thirdhand, to say, you know, maybe I'll call my cousin. Maybe I'll appeal to my father-in-law or brother-in-law or whatever to say, it's enough. get that stuff back. It's ridiculous that this stuff is still missing 25 years later.
Well, Steve Kirkchin, your book, Master Thieves, I know you wrote it with this in mind. I think it's a terrific contribution to this effort to bring those paintings back to Boston. And I want to thank you so much for sharing this story with us here on Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thank you very much for having me. I thought I got a little bit energized by it, but understand, I am a Boston boy. I grew up in this city. I spent my life working for the dominant newspaper that set the standards of proper conduct, in whether in politics or in business. You know, the Globe stood for something, and to be able to have any effect to making progress in this case, whether with my interviewing or with another approach, you know, to be a great legacy for this Boston boy. I feel a real close tie to this museum, but what the most important thing is, Boston is a city that has recovered from a terrorist attack of 2013. And it is a city that's not just on the rebound, because I never felt with that. You know, I always thought we were in a privileged place by living in Boston. But we have really come back strong, and the city sees itself as a stronger, dynamic, a city that can address the problems. When you talk about Boston, you talk about a city that's strong, strong people, believe in themselves, believe in the right things. And I think to use that energy, to use that spirit of commitment that we can do this towards the Gardner Museum theft, to get these masterpieces back on the wall would be a coup.
Investigative reporter Stephen Kirkchin. His book is Master Thieves. You can read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, George Black on the lethal legacy of the Vietnam War. Stay tuned after the break.
Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? You're only dancing on this earth for a short while. And though your dreams may toss and turn you now, they will vanish away like your daddy's best jeans, denim blue, fading up to the sky. And though you want them to last forever, you know we never will. You know we never will. And the patches make the goodbye harder still. Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? There'll never be a better chance to change your mind. And if you want this world to see better days, will you carry the words of love with you? Will you write?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The Vietnam War ended on April 30, 1975, but for thousands of Vietnamese families, the war is still wreaking havoc on their lives. The U.S. dropped more bombs on Vietnam than were dropped on Nazi Germany during World War II. 10% of those bombs remain unexploded, and they've been maiming and killing men, women, and children ever since. An even more insidious injury has been wrought on the genetic health of the population. The millions of tons of herbicides sprayed over the fields and forests of Vietnam by the U.S. have left a legacy of birth defects and cancers that have continued to affect generation after generation born since the war. George Black writes about that lethal legacy of the Vietnam War in the March 16, 2015 issue of The Nation. He also writes about one Vietnam vet who returned to that country decades after the war to undo some of the damage done. That vet is Chuck Searcy. He founded Project Renew to find and render harmless unexploded ordnance, as well as help families cope with the effects of defoliants like Agent Orange.
So Chuck Searcy is a very interesting character. He's very charismatic. He's very low-key at the same time. He's 70 years old. He served in Vietnam for a year, 67-68, as a military intelligence analyst, and turned against the war in 68. But he was never what you would think of as, you know, a conventional anti-war activist. He wasn't like Tom Cruise in Born on the 4th of July, angry out in the streets. He was very quiet. Came from a very conservative background in Alabama and Georgia, opposed the war, really giving speeches to the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis, and handing out leaflets at Georgia college football games. And then had a very conventional career for 20 years in Georgia politics. He served in military intelligence and really became disillusioned with the war for two reasons. One was that he saw the raw intelligence reports that he was analyzing being massaged until they really reflected the war that Washington would have liked to think was happening rather than the actual war that was happening. So he became cynical about that. And then the second thing was just the scale of the violence that was carried out, especially midway through his year in Saigon, came the Tet Offensive, which was the biggest nationwide wave of attacks by the Viet Cong. And in response to small-scale hit-and-run guerrilla attacks, he saw this extraordinary firepower unleashed on South Vietnam, with artillery barrages and ships firing from offshore and aircraft and helicopters and napalm and 500-pound bombs. He saw entire neighborhoods just reduced to rubble by bombing and shelling. And I think those two things, the disillusionment with the lies that were being told, and then the disproportionate nature of the conflict in pure technological terms, those really turned him against the war. So when he went back, as I said, he spent 20 years in a fairly conventional career path, then went back to Vietnam for the first time in 1992 out of curiosity with another vet, went back a couple of times, and finally in 1995 settled in Hanoi and has never left. Towards the end of the 1990s, after diplomatic relations were restored with the U.S., he became very attuned to the remarkable, shocking fact that 10% of all the bombs that were dropped on Vietnam never exploded. And people were walking on them in the fields the whole time, getting blown up, killed, maimed, blinded. And he settled on Quang Tri province, which is right in the center of Vietnam. It was the province that divided south from north. The old demilitarized zone, the DMZ, ran through the middle of Quang Tri province, the most heavily bombed place in the country, and in fact, the most heavily bombed place in the history of the world. And more bombs were dropped there than on Nazi Germany in the whole of World War II, which, when you think of the size of the place, 60 miles north to south, 30 miles east to west, is an amazing thought. And people were being killed in large numbers. Several thousand people in Quang Tri have died. So he developed Project Renew, opened it in the town of Dong Ha in Quang Tri in 2001. And since then has set up a very, very elaborate public information communication system where most of the villagers now know that if they find something in their fields, there's a hotline they can call, and demolition crews go out usually 3 to 5 times a day, which is in itself shocking. We went out one day with a crew that was searching for cluster bombs and finding them in a field prior to detonation. Another day we went out with a crew, a different kind of crew, who were responding to an emergency call from some farmers who had found grenades and a white phosphorus bomb at the edge of the village soccer field where kids were playing soccer. So we went out, they blew them up, and this is a daily occurrence. Then after more than a decade of this, you know, the other problem that was so apparent in Quang Tri province and throughout the country was the number of families who were still struggling with the impact of herbicidal spraying, chemical sprays, including predominantly Agent Orange, and the millions of people who were exposed to that during the war, and the hundreds of thousands who have sickened and had children with birth defects as a consequence.
And tell us what those birth defects were. You visited a family where all of the children had been affected.
So when you go around these villages, as I did with Circe and some of his Vietnamese colleagues, the stunning thing about them is that many of these households have not only one or two kids with birth defects, some of them have more than five. There is one district, this is a province of 600,000 people, one district of the 10 districts within the province, which maybe has, oh, somewhere 50 to 75,000 people, has 117 households with five or more disabled kids, which is just an extraordinary idea. And they can be all sorts of disabilities. You may have one who has, you know, arms and legs that look like matchsticks. You may have another who has a cleft palate, another who has fingers and toes webbed together, or too many fingers and toes. The families that I visited, this one in particular, had two girls living at home, both of them ironically diagnosed with cerebral palsy. And this actually, just to add a little word about the problems on the Vietnamese side with this, one of the reasons the Vietnamese, one has to say, have not got further with their claims is that they have a tendency to treat any kind of birth defect as the consequence of Agent Orange. Now, part of this is lack of science there. Part of this is obviously the anger or the sadness that attaches. But the way it happens is that Vietnamese doctors diagnose a birth defect, ascribe it to Agent Orange, and then the families are eligible for a very small government pension. They get about $17 US per child. In this particular family, these two kids were diagnosed with cerebral palsy. Now, that is not a birth defect that is listed on the Veterans Administration list here as being Agent Orange linked. These girls obviously had many other problems, too. They were both severely mentally disabled, which is not necessarily associated with cerebral palsy. You can have very bright people with cerebral palsy. It doesn't necessarily affect intellectual development. But the stress on this woman in particular, well, both of them, both the parents who are getting on in years, they have to take shifts to care for these two girls around the clock. I thought, looking at these girls when I got there, that they were maybe 10, 11, 12 years old. It turned out they were well into their 20s. They just never grew. And the parents have to work around the clock in shifts because one of the daughters in particular just doesn't sleep. She screams and cries all night, makes these kind of grunting sounds and squall. I mean, it's just a terrible scene. And they have two other kids who are able to live semi-independently, but also have birth defects. One daughter is in her first year of college in Dongha. She's 19 or 20 years old. She weighs 60 pounds. She has legs and arms that stick out at peculiar angles and aren't properly developed. They have a son who's training to be a motorbike mechanic, and he has these strange abnormal bone growths in his legs and suffers a lot of pain from them. And, you know, it's family after family you could describe who have this kind of situation at home.
George Packer says 4.8 million Vietnamese have been exposed to the defoliants.
We know this from the work of really the world's leading expert on the history of the Agent Orange spraying program, Ranch Hand, a woman called Jean Stellman, who is a professor emerita at the School of Public Health at Columbia University, longtime specialist in occupational safety and health, chemist by training. And she spent literally decades combing through and collating data from the flight records of the Agent Orange spraying flights and reconstructing with absolute precision, I mean, literally down to 4 decimal points of accuracy of degrees, minutes, and seconds, latitude and longitude. So you can see exactly where the flights went. Not every single one, but more than 9,000 flights, the great majority. And you can see who was exposed, who was resident there at the time. It also applies to American service people who were in the vicinity in the time. You can measure their exposure. And she's got a very complex set of algorithms in this database that allow you to do this with that kind of exactitude. And that was what allowed me also, using the database, which isn't yet public, to go into the villages to see exactly, you know, the families I visited. I could literally reconstruct where they were on a particular day in relation, you know, they described the planes going over. And I would say that was flight 1173 on such and such a date in 1966. And it dropped X thousand gallons of Agent Orange. This is all Stellman's work.
She also says that it's not just the defoliants that have reaped such a horrendous harvest of birth defects and environmental damage, that it was a whole panoply of things. What does she ascribe this kind of destruction to?
Well, it was defoliation of forest cover that the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army were using. It was also the desiccation and destruction of crops. mainly by another agent, Agent Blue, which is a carcinogenic compound that contains an arsenical. So people would be going out into their fields with nothing else to eat. And literally, I had families, you know, describing going out into the fields, either being under the spray themselves or going out after the planes had passed. And the crops were dead, but they had nothing else to eat, so they're eating their crops. So it was dual purpose. It was defoliation of forests. It was destruction of crops that might give sustenance to the enemy. And obviously the purpose of that was a military purpose, to win the war, to save American lives. And, you know, even more than being appalled by what happened, Stelman's real deeper complaint is that so many of the birth defects perhaps cannot be ascribed to Agent Orange, but to the multitude of other things to which these people were exposed. Because if you were in these villages that were sprayed by Agent Orange, and this is based on the testimony of the families I interviewed, you were also carpet bombed by B-52s. You were napalmed. You saw your family members and neighbors incinerated next to you. You had ground troops storming through your villages fighting. Your villages were burned down. You were herded into encampments behind barbed wire. You were suffering malnutrition. You know, the number of stressors that can then manifest themselves in later health problems were absolutely enormous. It wasn't just the herbicides that did it.
What is the attitude of the people of Vietnam themselves, the victims of this terrible war crime, I think is what you can call it? What is their response now to the Americans and to what has happened to them?
That's not a simple question to answer. It has a number of parts to it. The extraordinary thing Searcy said when I first met him back in November, when he was describing going back to Vietnam in 1992, and then when he settled in 1995, he said that the incredibly striking thing was that he never received a word of hostility from a Vietnamese, despite being an American, despite having served in the American military in Vietnam. And the more he became acquainted with other veterans and began organizing annual tours for veterans to come back, several of whom settled in Vietnam and have remained friends, none of them reported ever hearing hostility from Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And when I talked to Vietnamese about that, which I did very often, Vietnamese from all walks of life, there were various explanations. You know, the most obvious one is it was all a long time ago. And I would say to them, well, I had an uncle who was taken prisoner by the Japanese in Burma and tortured. And, you know, to the day he died 45, 50 years later, he would not have a Japanese product in the house. You know, so they'd say, well, we won the war. And I said, well, yeah, Britain won the war in World War II. But, and then other people would say, you know, we're a naturally forgiving people, or it's a spiritual thing, or Confucius said that if you show anger toward your enemy, you stoop to the level of the barbarian. Families, heartbreakingly, this one woman who had several disabled kids said to me that she thought ghosts were responsible, evil spirits, or that people had done wrong in a previous life. You know, the younger people obviously don't have a memory, and they're very focused now on economic growth and development. They're very pro-American. As far as the families themselves are concerned, the presumed victims of Agent Orange are represented in Vietnam by an organization called VAVA, which is the Vietnamese Association of Victims of Agent Orange and Dioxin. And that is run largely by former senior military officers. And on that side of the government, yes, there is still a lot of frustration, a lot of anger. Other parts of the government are not and never have been keen to raise the issue. Vietnam has been very, very focused on economic development, even though it's a one-party state run by, you know, the victorious North Vietnamese, former North Vietnamese communists. It is a very vibrant, developing economy, and they really prize good relationships with the United States. So you get this division that goes way, way back to the beginning of diplomatic relations. You know, even when the first U.S. ambassador arrived in 1995 and denounced any talk of Agent Orange as propaganda, and the Vietnamese were bending over backwards to help the Americans find MIAs, servicemen missing in action, digging up Vietnamese war cemeteries to try to find American bodies. But they wouldn't bring up the idea of Agent Orange because they didn't want to jeopardize the opening to the U.S. And still to this day, you know, when the Vietnamese finally were given a machine to test for dioxin, they used it to test for the presence of dioxin in catfish that were being brought up in ponds in the Mekong Delta in areas that had been sprayed with Agent Orange, because they didn't want to become known as the country that was trying to export poisoned fish. So there's been that division of opinion. The former military people that I met, the retired general and retired colonel who are in charge of VAVA at the national level, they still want an admission from the United States that a crime was committed. And you know, the sad fact is they're never going to get it. The United States does not admit to such things and will never apologize for this. So the amount of compensation they can ever expect is very, very limited.
So you say that the U.S. doesn't apologize for things, but there are also other reasons, economic interests that are involved here that you speak about in your article, George Black, in The Lethal Legacy of the Vietnam War, which is in the current issue of The Nation. What are some of the economic interests?
Well, on the part of the companies who produced Agent Orange, there's obviously a huge amount of influence. One of the many, many ironies I found in Vietnam is that Monsanto, which was one of the two biggest producers of Agent Orange, along with Dow Chemical, has now just opened an office in Vietnam to promote its seeds for agriculture.
Genetically modified organisms.
Well, GMO certainly included in that, and Monsanto has obviously been criticized a great deal for creating these relationships of dependency where you need their inputs in order to grow your crops. The seeds are patented, and so you lock the purchasing country into this cycle where they have to buy more and more from Monsanto. So that's one thing.
Also, these seeds are genetically engineered to withstand pesticides, so more pesticides can be used, which seems to sharpen the irony even further.
Well, that's right. And of course, Monsanto obviously still produces pesticides and herbicides. In fact, another irony is that the largest selling herbicide in the world is still one of the two components of Agent Orange.
Well, this is a terrific article, The Lethal Legacy of the Vietnam War. I think what's so important about your article, George Black, is that you do bring together all these different impacts, as well as the human, you know, the emotional impact for the reader of understanding exactly what went on there, how people were actually affected. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
George Black is editor-at-large at the Food and Environment Reporting Network, or FERN. His work appears in The Nation and the Los Angeles Times. His most recent book, Empire of Shadows, The Epic Story of Yellowstone, was a finalist for the 2013 Los Angeles Times Book Prize. His article, The Lethal Legacy of the Vietnam War, is in the March 16th issue of The Nation. Go to www.thenation.com to read it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.